Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
Did Morales just pull an Isaiah Thomas, just walked off?
Just walked off, right in the middle of his big intro, just said, I don't know. I don't know.
What's going on, man? How was your weekend? Man.
It was great. We had company. Everybody's been tested, so we had company. Juan's in-laws came in, which was great. Juan's mom and stepdad came in, and we had a really nice time for 24 hours. I had somebody to talk to. It was really cool. had somebody in the house. Had somebody to hang out with. John, how was your weekend?
Good. Went and saw my mom for the first time in 6 weeks, other than waving to her outside the window, so that was fun.
How's Myrna? She's doing good.
Everybody's good. And
play a little golf?
Yeah, played Saturday. And
you got out on the home course?
Yep, things are starting to get back to normal over there, so that's good. And I thought The Last Dance last night was one of the best. I can't believe there's only two episodes left. One night left.
It's been so good, and last night was such a great episode.
Matter of fact, somebody who was in it last night is going to join us in a couple of minutes. Mike Barnett, the guy who was the hitting coach in Birmingham, he went on to the majors like the manager, Terry Francona, did.
Yep.
Barnett went on to coach in the majors. He's now the Indians. Lindsay, is he still the Indians hitting coach? I know he was for a long time.
He's their assistant hitting coach at the Indians, yeah.
Okay, assistant hitting coach. There
him and Francona have kind of hung around together since those days in Birmingham, so we'll talk to Mike about some of that stuff. But I just think this Last Dance is fantastic. I mean, the ratings keep coming in every week, and they're getting monster ratings each week, but it is I think Michael Jordan, Chris played it a little bit in that open, thought that people were going to think less of him. I don't know how you can. I think it's just cements him as an all-time icon in the game.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. Funch, do you have that? Because I think we pulled aside that last sort of 30 seconds of episode.
Yeah, this is episode 7. I wrote a note to you this morning. I think this encapsulates, if you don't understand Michael, and by the way, this is something Kobe used to say all the time, too. You know, Kobe modeled his game after Jordan. But, you know, if you're watching, if you're one of the people that Jordan was worried about, and you're watching him berate his teammates, and you hear the story of him punching Steve Kerr in the eye, and you wonder, you think, what a jerk. He explained last night at the end of episode 7 why he did that, and here's what he said.
When people see this, they're going to say, well, he wasn't really a nice guy. He may have been a tyrant. Oh, well, that's you, because you never wanted anything. I wanted to win, but I wanted them to win and be a part of that as well. Like, I don't have to do this. I'm only doing it because it is who I am. That's how I played the game. That was my mentality. If you don't want to play that way, don't play that way. Break.
And as in, I'm taking a break, and you could tell he was getting emotional.
There you have Michael Jordan in a nutshell. When we take away, I have a feeling when we walk away from this 10-hour incredible documentary experience, that 30 seconds is the 30 seconds that will encapsulate who Michael Jordan is, who he has been, the way he approached the sport, and the reason why he won so damn much.
I give this speech a lot on the show, but every once in a while you'll run into somebody in sports who has that indeterminable will that there aren't very many people. There may be maybe five I've ever seen that they are so driven that they can't exist if they don't win.
Right.
I've told the story many times that and I'll take it to my grave. I'm absolutely convinced the reason the Lakers won back-to-back titles in 09 and 10 is because they got their ass kicked in the last game of the 08 finals.
Right.
And Kobe just said, you know what? I'm not having it. And if you talk to people that were on that team, and that was similar to the story Jordan told last night about how he got back from playing baseball and he saw some guys on the team that weren't there when they won the first three titles. And they were coming to practice
kind of
smiling,
basking in the glory of it all.
Yeah. kind of smiling and taking it easy. And
Kerr was one of them.
Yeah, and not having you know, what he considered to be the seriousness of competition. Luke Walton told me a story once that after a week, after that Celtics game, those guys always used to decompress and take the summers off. And, you know, Luke would go play volleyball with, you know, Geeter and Richard Jefferson and all those dudes. And he said his phone rang, or might have been a text, and Kobe said, "What are you doing?" He goes, "I'm just hanging out." He goes, "No, what are you doing right now? What did you do in the gym today?" He goes, "You got to do something every day. We're not having it next year. We're just, I'm never putting myself in that position again." And that's why Jordan punched Steve Kerr in the eye.
Sure.
That's why, you know, Mike Barnett, who's coming up, will tell you that's why Jordan was on the breaking ball machine before batting practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And hanging out after batting practice. And, like, you know, there are just some people that are the first ones there and they're the last ones to leave. And they can't sleep and they can't eat unless they dedicate themselves to winning.
And joining us right now is the assistant hitting coach for the Cleveland Indians, and he was Michael Jordan's hitting coach with the Birmingham Barons back in 1994. Mike Barnett joins us. Mike, thanks for coming on. How are you, man?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you doing?
We're doing great, Mike, and we really appreciate you doing this. We know your phone's ringing with a lot of these requests, and we appreciate you taking ours. And I was just talking about the fact that, and I'll let you comment on it, but every once in a while you run into somebody in our line of work or your line of work where they're just so driven that you can tell right away they're not gonna be able to eat, sleep, or function unless they get it right. And my sense was, listening to you and listening to Terry Francona last night, that's how Jordan approached Birmingham. That you instead of a guy who could have been the last one there and the first one to leave, it sounded like you were describing him as the opposite, right?
Well, I tell you what, he is the absolute hardest worker I've ever been around. I mean, the toughest competitor, and competing against himself. I mean, trying to get better at baseball when he didn't have to do that. But, you know, a lot of people have talked about all of this, a publicity stunt, everything like that. It was anything but that. This guy was trying to make the major leagues as a baseball player. In a different sport that he had excelled in. And I'll tell you what, it was a joy to be around him every day and, you know, learn so many lessons from him. You know, I think when you're coaching, I think one thing that you have to take away is you probably learn more from your players than you learn from anything else. And just watching him go about his day-to-day, the way he went about things, the way he handled failure, too, at times, was absolutely amazing. And, yeah, this guy, you know, if he had showed up at 4 o'clock and, you know, okay, I'm just going to take batting practice and play the game. But this guy was one of the first guys to the ballpark every day. And it was fun to see and watch the progress he made. I mean, this guy made more progress in 5 months of a minor league baseball season than most guys make in a year and a half to 2 years.
Hmm. So you're a hitting coach with Birmingham, and all of a sudden you find out Michael Jordan is going to be one of your players. What goes through your mind when that moment comes along?
Well, you know what? I mean, I have to admit it was a little bit, you know, a little bit of nervousness because you don't know what to expect. How's this guy going to be? How's he going to react to you? And how are we going to hit it off? And it was interesting, you know, we kind of found out probably about 10 days maybe before that he was going to join us. And when we actually, probably about 4 or 5 days before we broke camp, we found out for sure he was coming with us, and we got together in the cage in the morning. And I'd been around Michael, seeing him and stuff like that, but, you know, never really bothered him and stuff like that. And now I'm going to be his hitting coach. And the things that I threw out at him, I said, I've talked to scouts. I said, I've watched, you know, a good number of at-bats that he had, you know, had in spring training that year. I talked to a lot of scouts, and the scouts said, yeah, just pound him with fastballs in. If he gets there, you know, it's probably going to be a little dribbler down the third base line. So I kind of threw these things out at him, and I just said, you know, you're off the plate, you're diving in, you're kind of blocking yourself off. And I said, for me, I said, I think if we can get you a little bit more up on the plate or just in an even, because, I mean, big guy, 6'7",
yeah,
long levers. And I said, if we can get you just a little bit more squared up in the box and working straight ahead, I said, because I can guarantee you the first couple weeks of the season, that's what they're going to do is pound you in with fastballs. And he said, well, I've seen that the last couple weeks. So he did have a little bit of experience with some at-bats to go on as far as that goes. And I said, I think, you know, it's going to make a difference in you being able to get the fastball in. So I said, but it's completely up to you. You tell me. And I said, if you want to continue doing what you're doing, you're comfortable with that, we'll work around that. He said, no, that makes absolute sense. He goes, let's get to work. And from that point on, you know, we had a tremendous relationship. He was amazing to work with day in and day out. Because like you said, he was constantly trying to get better. And it was a process. And I think that, you know, the thing that it was fun to see, because the first, I started out with about a 13-game hitting streak that I don't think people remember. I mean, you look at the final numbers, you go, oh, well, 201 or 202, he didn't really have he wasn't a very good baseball player. But for him to be able to get the fastballs, and to me, the mark of, you know, if a guy's going to play in the major leagues, he's got to be able to hit the fastball. And he proved that in that 13-game hitting streak, because he's getting the head of the bat there on good fastballs. He's getting some ground ball base hits through the 5-6 hole. He's sneaking some balls down the line for doubles. And he's starting to feel pretty good about himself. Then we come to the next step to where, okay, I'm waiting every night. When's it going to happen? And it finally did. They just started throwing him nothing but breaking balls. He didn't see a fastball in the zone for a month and a half. And they realized, okay, well, this guy can hit a fastball. And he's so competitive, he was going to hit every breaking ball that came up there. And so then we had to step back, and that's where we started really doing a lot of the breaking ball machine work. And we had to set it up on a hanging breaking ball just to get him the idea of what the shape of a hanging breaking ball looks like. And then I'd also throw him some little bit more nasty ones and say, these are the ones you got to lay off of. And so for a guy that really didn't have a ton of bad experiences, to be able to take that and get better every day. And the natural progression with a young player is, okay, well, I'm starting to see the hanger, but I can't pull the trigger. And then eventually they start seeing the hanger, they're able to take advantage of them. And a lot of times that takes a year and a half for guys to get to that point. With him, he started making that change in about a month and a half time. And that's why I just think it was amazing. And what he did was truly unbelievable to step into Double-A baseball. And you want to say he didn't have success? I think he had tremendous success.
We're talking to Mike Barnett, who was Michael Jordan's hitting coach in Birmingham with the Barons. That was covered last night in The Last Dance. Mike is now with the Cleveland Indians, as was the manager for the Barons back then, Terry Francona. Mike and Terry have worked together in different places. Mike, this is I just found this fascinating, that Michael Jordan decided he wanted to do something for the team, and so he got you guys a bus. What was the biggest difference between the bus you had before Jordan got there and the one he ended up helping get you guys?
Well, it was kind of a rickety old bus of the bus company we had, you know, but it worked. It was basically what you would see, you know, a lot of Double-A clubs, you know, riding around in 1994. But so he wanted to make sure that, you know, we had a decent bus and everything like that. And really, it was probably a normal bus, which you would see today. And really, he didn't buy the bus. He just paid the difference on the lease. He told the bus company, if you get a new good bus, and he said, the only thing I ask is, can we get a bench seat in the back so if I want to lay down or something
right,
like that.
Right, because he's so tall.
We could do that. Yeah, so they got that, and he paid the difference on the lease, but he didn't actually buy the bus. And so it was a nice thing to cruise around in the Southern League. And but he spent most of the time up front with us because the coaching staff, Tito, Kirk Champion, and myself were closer to his age than, you know, a lot of the guys on the team. And we would end up, you know, playing Yahtzee and team Yahtzee and against each other and blackjack up front. And because he loves to compete. It didn't make any difference what he was doing. He had to compete on something for sure.
Mike, you said at some point that you felt like Michael could have made it to the major leagues. I want to take that one step further. Who would he have been like had he gotten to the major leagues? What player would sort of be a comp for who Michael Jordan could have been as a major league player?
Well, I look back, when he came to us, he was 30 years old, and I don't think he could have been probably an everyday player for a first division club at that point. But if he had gotten another 1,500 at bats in the minor leagues, which probably would have been, playing in AAA the next year and then maybe going back to the fall league, if he had gotten to that point, he could have been a solid fourth outfielder on a club and contribute. Because of the fact that, like I said, when he started out on a 20 to 80 scale that we usually grade on, his power was a 20 starting out. Mm-hmm. By the end of the year, he's hitting 10, 12 balls out of the ballpark every day. He hit his three home runs in Birmingham, which at that time was probably the third or fourth toughest park in all of minor league baseball to hit a home run in. He hit 260 in August. So offensively, he was developing an approach. He was able to stay on the baseball. And if you made a mistake, he was going to make you pay and drive the baseball. His arm was probably a 20 arm. By the time we got to the end of the year, it was close to a 50 arm, which would have been a solid average arm. And defensively, he took such pride in defense, obviously being, the defensive player of the year in basketball, he was going to make sure he was going to be the best defensive player he could be. So I could have seen him being a solid fourth outfielder for a club because he could absolutely run, could steal a base. He used that understanding pitchers' tendencies, same as he did understanding players' tendencies, as far as playing defense and basketball, to learn how to steal bases better. He had tremendous instinct. So you look at that point, he could have been a solid fourth outfielder. But I've said if he had come out of high school and went the baseball route instead of the basketball route, I could have seen him ending up being, like a player like Dave Winfield.
Wow.
I really do.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, and I had the pleasure of being with Dave Winfield, too, with the Yankees, and just a tremendous guy and the drive and the will to succeed. And I could just see if Michael, had changed his body to be more of a baseball player body and everything like that. And that was some of the stuff they talked about in the documentary. He was starting to adjust to a baseball body, and then when he came back to basketball, he had to go back the other way.
Yep.
But he was going to find a way to be successful no matter what sport he was playing. And, he just loved the competition. And I love the line that he said, would you have a gambling problem? He says, no, I have a competition problem. And
yep.
I couldn't agree with that more.
Well, listen, Mike, we appreciate you coming on. Thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts on this. We appreciate it. And I hope we get a real baseball season coming up pretty soon, too.
Me too. It sounds like we're getting closer, but there's a lot of things to work out. But I'm looking forward to it for sure, guys. And thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mike. There's Mike Barnett, who was Michael Jordan's hitting coach for the Birmingham Barons in the Southern League.
Let's talk about what he just mentioned coming up. This plan, this Major League Baseball plan, kind of leaked out today. And I just got done watching Jeff Passan on SportsCenter.
Yep.
And he says the players are biting back a little bit. It's not I still think they're going to end up playing baseball, and so does Passan, but it might not be as much of a slam dunk as everybody thinks.
Yep, we'll get into that coming up next for you, Mason and Ireland, 710 ESPN. All right, 710 ESPN, Mason and Ireland. It is Monday. That's right, Monday. It's a whole new day. John, bad news. After a really good start to the quarantine, I've now gained 7 pounds.
Yeah, but
seven
like I told you before, the quarantine is not over yet. You have plenty of time to swing the pendulum back the other way.
That's what I'm going to do. I was just eating raw vegetables, John. Raw vegetables. I'm coming back. I'm going to rally. All right, so Major League Baseball, they are in talks right now, or there's going to be a presentation by the MLB owners tomorrow to the MLBPA, the Players Association. And there are sticking points in an agreement that would start spring training 2.0 in June and start the regular season, an 82-game schedule in July, John.
Well, first of all, let me say that if that happened, I'd be really happy. I think 82 games at this point is as good as we can expect. I think that it would be great. Matter of fact, some other byproducts that come out of there. They want the teams to play the games in their home stadium with those revised divisions. And if your state isn't like New York, probably isn't going to be cleared to play in Yankee Stadium and in Citi Field, they can then go to their spring training facilities. That's the backup plan. If you're a team that can't get into your home stadium because of the pandemic, you do have the option of going to spring training and playing your games there. So that answers the question, what would you do with the Yankees and the Mets, or even if Gavin Newsom didn't want to let these guys play baseball, the Angels and Dodgers could go to Arizona.
And by the way, a universal designated hitter is one of the proposals.
Right. Rosters also go from 30 to 50. Now, I don't think that means you'd have 50 guys in the dugout. I think that means you can have that many active players on your roster and then just put as many as you think you're going to need into the dugout for that game.
An expansion of the playoffs from 10 to 14 teams.
Why not?
Which would mean 3 division winners, 4 wild cards, and only one team would get a bye. The team with the best record in the league would get a bye, and everybody else would have to play in the first round.
Now, what's holding this up is in the other major sports, in basketball and in football, they have a revenue share.
Yep.
In other words, if you just take all the money that the sport makes and you divide it based on what the revenue, like the NBA is 50-50. I don't know if the NFL is 50-50. I think the NFL tilts a little bit towards the owners. But I don't think there is a revenue share per se in baseball, right? So any money that came in,
correct,
the owners would get all the money.
Yep.
And the players are saying, look, we're taking a reduction in salary. We should share in whatever profits come in. And to me, that sounds like something that could be resolved, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. Now, here's what I don't understand. Players want a prorated portion of their salaries depending on the number of games played. So, in other words, if you make $30 million, you want a prorated portion of $30 million, regardless of whether there is profit or not. So the owners would make less because of no fans, but the players want their prorated portion, 82 games worth of, say, $30 million instead of any sort of rev share.
Well, again,
so
this
actually seems like a financial hurdle.
Right, but this to me all sounds negotiable. It sounds like you get a couple of CPAs in a room and you can figure it out. For example, baseball is the one sport that is more dependent on attendance than any other sport. 30% of the overall revenue in MLB comes from gate attendance. And that's because there's so many games.
Yep.
You know, if you play 162 games, and you're going to knock it down to half that. So instead of the Dodgers having 81 home games, they're going to have 40. Obviously, that's going to affect everything. So I think you come up with numbers that would be palatable to both sides, and you say, do we want to play or not? And I hope nobody is going to die on that hill, going to say,
right,
Nope, we have to have it exactly our way or it's not going to happen. Just come up with a number that's fair and give us a season. I think that's totally reasonable.
Yeah, it sounds like they are in the ballpark of an agreement. And that is significant. And by the way, you know, the expanded rosters, a 30-man roster with a 20-man taxi squad, gives you a lot of flexibility player-wise. Now, the one question that isn't answered, actually, we'll take a break. There's a question that isn't answered in this scenario. And by the way, top of the hour, Craig Hodges, who was a teammate of Michael Jordan's, will join us. He was very upset. even though he wasn't there, he was upset about the traveling cocaine circus comment a couple of weeks back from Michael Jordan on The Last Dance. And again, also a teammate of Michael Jordan's. He will join us at 4 o'clock.
One of the three best shooters I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Phenomenal. That's coming up for you at the top of the hour. Mason and Ireland, 710 ESPN. Your show! Mason and Ireland, 710 ESPN. What's going on? By the way, lots of ways to reach us. 877-710 ESPN on the phones. Also, hashtag Ask Mason and Ireland. And you can email me direct for the show email address, venicemace@gmail.com. So, John, the one question, and it sounds like they're making progress with baseball. It sounds like spring training 2.0 potentially starts in June, and then an 82-game season will start in July, which is fantastic. What still hasn't been answered and what still I wonder about is what happens if somebody tests positive? Right? I mean, it's this is going to be the eternal question for every sport as it goes to get started.
No, I'm glad you brought this up. Because it happened at UFC over the weekend. UFC had an 11-fight card in Jacksonville. And on Friday night, one of the fighters tested positive for COVID.
Right.
And he had participated in a weigh-in and everything. They just said, you're out. You're not fighting. They quarantined him, and they went on with the event. And so now we're waiting to see if there were any after effects of that. But that's the way they handled it. They didn't consider it a showstopper, for lack of a better term. They basically just said, okay, we knew this was a possibility. That's why we tested everybody. And let's now just quarantine the guy who tested positive and go from there. Matter of fact, Mace, there's a lot of... I know you didn't watch it. Lindsay, did you watch the UFC over the weekend?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So, by all accounts, this fighter that tested positive was named Jacare Souza.
Yep.
And they quarantined him. He didn't fight. Joe Rogan, who has been like the ring announcer for these things, the guy even did traditional interviews in the ring without a mask, and shook hands with at least one of the competitors who didn't have a glove on. After the fight, Rogan said this. He said, quote, "It didn't make any sense to me. If everybody's been tested and everybody's clean, no one has the disease. I've been tested. They've been tested. I want to see them. When I'm doing an interview with a fighter, I want to look him in the eye. I don't want it to be some impersonal thing where he's 100 feet away from me."
Right.
End quote. So if there are no negative effects here, Mace, nobody gets sick, it's going to be interesting. Do you think the UFC should be praised for being the first sport back, or should they be criticized for being reckless?
Oh, no. I think it's totally fine that they're the first sport back. It's an individual sport. It's easy to test everybody afterwards. I think the concern would be if someone actually gets sick, because it's one thing to test positive. It's another thing to actually get sick.
Lindsay, did you note, was it obvious when Rogan was interviewing people without a mask and shaking hands? Was that a big deal, or did it just look normal?
No, it looked completely normal. And like he said, I mean, they tested everybody the day before or the morning. I think it was the day before, and then had everybody isolate while they got their results back. And then, the next day they went to the arena and did their fights. And it was a totally normal fight to me. I mean, I didn't even really notice that there wasn't fans there, to be honest.
See, the difference, here's the difference. So that's a one-night event. So that to me is a no-brainer. You isolate the one guy, you do your one-night event. That doesn't mean nobody has it. That just means for that
which
one
is why
night, they're fine.
This aftermath is important. And actually, it wasn't one guy. It was 22 guys. They had 11 fights.
So, but here you've got, let's say somebody in baseball, somebody on a team test positive. You've got 82 of the next 110 days you're playing baseball games. It's not a one-night event. It's an event that goes every single day, sometimes 7 days a week. And so it's going to be a moving lab experiment, right?
Right. But I think what you'll see with the schedule is rather than the Dodgers making two trips to Houston to play the Astros.
Right.
Maybe they make one trip.
And yeah, I think you cut down on travel, sure.
You play Tuesday, Wednesday, you play Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, take Thursday off, play Friday, Saturday, Sunday, all in Houston.
Yes.
And then you do the same thing when the two teams come back to L.A.
So yeah, I mean, I think you just that's one of the things is you know, you can mitigate risk. I don't think you can eliminate risk.
Totally agree.
And that's going to be part of all of this.
And when you do, I think you handle it like the UFC did. Guy tests positive. Not everybody, don't freak out. We knew this was possible. That fighter's off the card. He's quarantined. And we continue to test everybody else. And that's why
the only problem
is
if somebody actually gets sick. Not just test positive, but actually get sick.
Right. And that somebody played, and then you know after the fact that that guy played in a game with the virus.
Right.
But then, don't you just test everybody else?
Yeah, you definitely just test everybody else. Here's the part of it I don't get. Like, so they've got a bunch of different tests now, right? They got a 5-minute test. They've got a test that takes 2 or 3 days. They've got a test that takes 7 to 10 days. My mom got her results back in 3 days.
Did you get yours back yet?
Yeah, I finally did get mine back. But it took 6 days.
Yeah, I was told 3 days, and I still haven't gotten mine, and I get tested on Thursday.
It took 6 days. So it's so sketchy in that way. If they've got that 5-minute test, then it's really easy to use. I mean, I don't know why there aren't more of those 5-minute tests, because those are just like automatic. We know in 5 minutes if you're positive or you're negative. If those can be more widespread, then this all becomes much easier to handle. Because right now, if it takes 3 days to get results, well, you're kind of 3 days in a holding pattern, because you really don't know who's been exposed and who hasn't been exposed.
Right. I mean, well, I heard an interview today on a podcast with Lindsay. Did you put this in the system where Mike Tirico was talking to Peter King? And Peter King suggested that they were talking about football. And like, if you bring football back. And Peter King suggested that if four guys tested positive the night before a game, you'd have to cancel the game. Why? Why wouldn't you just quarantine them?
Well, and by the way, I think he had just spoken to Dr. Fauci before he did that interview. Do I have that right, Lindsay?
Yep.
Peter King had just talked to Anthony Fauci. Did we pull that? I know we were playing it sort of before the show. Did we pull that Peter King sound?
I don't think so.
Yeah, he had just talked to.
I can pull it though if you want to.
He had just talked to Dr. Fauci, and then he talked to Mike Tirico.
Because I heard Dr. Fauci's comments today, and it made it sound to me like he was saying football is a different animal because those guys are right on top of each other and breathing and sweating and stuff. But Fauci made it sound like that the whole critical component was testing. That as long as you had the ability to test people, you know, pretty much daily if you needed to, you wouldn't necessarily have to, but test them daily if you needed to, then you could conceivably go forward with football. But what I didn't understand was when Peter said, if four guys test positive, you've got to cancel the game. I don't understand why you wouldn't just quarantine those and let the guys who didn't test positive play. They're obviously going to expand the rosters in all these sports.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, just to account for that possibility.
Yeah.
But Fauci is not, you know, like Charles Barkley and Shaquille O'Neal both came out over the weekend and said they think the NBA should cancel the season.
Yes.
Fauci is not one of those guys. He's not one of those guys saying cancel the season.
Well, Shaq is saying we should scrap this season and look ahead to next training camp. Shaq is saying. He's saying.
So is Barkley.
Yeah, and Barkley's saying the same thing. Do we have Barkley there, Funch? Let's listen to Barkley, what he said today.
It's too dangerous. It's not safe. I don't know how they can make it safe. You know, everybody's talking about putting them in a bubble in Vegas and in Florida, but you can't put the hotel workers in a bubble. You can't keep people who work room service in a bubble and people who work in the hotel. And I'm not sure players want to stay in a hotel for 2 straight months, but you can't leave the hotel to go out and get something to eat. You got to worry about the virus. So I said that about 3 weeks ago, they should cancel the season.
All right, so for guys who are suggesting that, And, you know, Charles and Shaq are Hall of Famers. They're yep. entitled to their opinion, and I think they're erring on the side of medical caution. But I would say this to both of them. There's a chance this virus is going to be around a year from now.
Sure.
Is that going to be your attitude a year from now? Because, Charles, all those conditions might exist. At some point, we have to restart the country and take some risks. And that's why I'm, like, whenever Anthony Fauci talks, I'm listening. Because he's the guy I want to know. That's the opinion that matters. It's very easy to err on the side of caution and say, cancel everything. And it's very easy to say, you know what, let's take a risk, let's go play now. No, let's listen to the doctors. These guys seem to have a better understanding of things than we do. And I think that's what Adam Silver's doing. He's talking to medical people all the time. And if Charles Barkley marries himself to that position, I'm not so sure that a year from now or 6 months from now when he wants to restart the next season or Shaq wants to restart the next season that the conditions are going to be much different.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's all very, very, it gets very tricky. It gets very, very tricky and well above my personal pay grade.
Which is why we should all listen to the doctors.
Yeah, yeah, the doctors are the smart ones. The doctors and the scientists are the smart ones. I want to go back to ask you something about Michael Jordan and that moment at the end of the seventh episode last night of The Last Dance that we played earlier. A gripping 30 seconds that really tells you who Michael Jordan is and the way he has approached sport and everything else in his life. We'll play that for you again. And then, John, I have a question for you about it.
Okay.
That's coming up next. Mason in Ireland, 710 ESPN. All right. So, you know, I think this is a philosophical question, John. Mason in Ireland, 710 ESPN. The end of episode 7 last night of The Last Dance, Michael Jordan kind of summarizes the way he approached the game and the way he dealt with teammates. Go ahead and play that, Funch.
When people see this, they're going to say, well, he wasn't really a nice guy. He may have been a tyrant. Oh, well, that's you, because you never won anything. I wanted to win, but I wanted them to win and be a part of that as well. Like, I don't have to do this. I'm only doing it because it is who I am. That's how I played the game. That was my mentality. If you don't want to play that way, don't play that way. Break.
Okay, so there is Michael Jordan. There is why he was so successful. Let me ask you this way. Do you think Michael Jordan is a happy person?
No. I think that he's tortured the same way Jerry West is tortured.
Right. So is it, if you have a choice between being a happy person who does fine in life, but isn't winning NBA championships, or let's just say average NBA player who's a really good player, but who isn't tortured in this way, or being tortured like that and winning championships, which would you rather be?
Well, I think I'd rather be happy, but I think 99% of people would rather have Michael Jordan's life than their own. Even though he's tortured.
But, like, for example, we all know, there's a great Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs. And
good
Steve
example.
Jobs
he's
was
tortured.
Tortured, treated people horribly, just an awful, awful guy who badgered and pushed and complained and argued and treated people terribly. Was that worth it? I mean, he created Apple, created the iPhone, created the MacBook, created everything that we see. But was that worth it?
I think Jordan would tell you, and he did just in that bite, that to him it is. If you don't want to play by his rules, that's fine. But he's going to steamroll you. He's ultra competitive. And, you know, an interesting question is, I mentioned that Kobe was like that, too. That,
right.
That Kobe would get on teammates hard. And you know, the five championships with Phil, those of us who were kind of around that team all the time knew that there was a good cop, bad cop routine between Kobe and Derek Fisher. That Kobe would come in and light people up, and Fisher would then walk up to him and go, you know what he means, right? You know, to make sure that the... But Kobe believed that the way you got the best out of people was to put their feet to the fire. And if they could handle that, then when you got into a playoff series and the game was on the line, that there was nothing they couldn't handle.
Right.
And that's Jordan's way. Now, that Jordan and Kobe are retired, and in the case of Kobe, he's tragically gone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that would fly in 2020. In other words, I don't know if there's another player.
That, you don't think LeBron is demanding that?
No. LeBron's almost the opposite of Jordan and Kobe. LeBron lifts up his teammates. He doesn't say, you know, F you, you know, you're soft as Charmin. You know, LeBron is like, hey, man, go to the corner and I'll throw you the ball. Kobe and Jordan are like, give me the ball. There's a huge difference between LeBron and those two guys. LeBron is going to go down, potentially, as the leading scorer in NBA history and top five in assists. I keep telling people there's never been anybody like LeBron.
But LeBron did go through teammates in Cleveland. I mean, the teammates were recycled. Guys were sent away and brought in based on how LeBron felt about them.
What I'm saying is, if Michael Jordan punched Steve Kerr in the eye.
Right.
Kobe punched Samaki Walker. I'd be
that
shocked.
That would not fly today.
Well, no, I'd be shocked. Even you're talking about the Cleveland days.
Yeah.
I'd be shocked if a story ever comes out that LeBron punched a teammate.
I don't think you can get away with that. You know, here's the difference, too. I mean, I was thinking about this last night as I was watching. Imagine if in the social media age, Michael Jordan had punched Steve Kerr at practice. First of all, we would know about it.
Right.
Second of all, it would be debated on everything from first
Mace,
take.
Wait a minute, though. I'm glad you brought this up. In the 80s and in the mid 90s, when Michael Jordan did that, you know what they called that? Tuesday.
Yeah.
There were fights in practice every day. Ask anybody who played in that era. Ask Michael. There were fights all. Byron Scott punched Michael. You know what they did? They talked it out and went back to practice the next day.
Right.
It back then, those guys will all tell you. Anybody from the, Craig Hodges is coming up in 10 minutes.
Yeah,
we'll talk to Craig about it. He'll back me up on this. There were fights in practice all the time, and you're right. If a fight happened in practice today, number one, it would get out. And number two would be the lead story on all the sports debate shows.
And number three, everybody in the world on Twitter and social media would have an opinion about it.
And probably call for the suspension of the guy that threw the punch.
Yes. We would be debating how long should that guy be suspended for.
Instead, you heard Steve Kerr last night on The Last Dance say, it was the best thing that ever happened to our relationship.
Because I stood up for myself.
Right. He said, after that, everything changed.
Yeah.
And by the way, I think it's why Kerr goes back at players like Kerr and Draymond have had to be separated at Golden State. They wanted to fight each other when they were winning titles at Golden State.
Yep.
And what Kerr said was the way Draymond and I came to respect each other was neither one of us want to ever back down. And we never will. I'm not backing down. He's not backing down. So we have to reach a compromise for the good of the group. And that's what we've learned how to do.
Yep.
But he said, we might get in a fight tomorrow. But now we'd hear about it. We'd hear about it within a day. It would get out. Somebody would tell their agent. Their agent would tell Woj. Woj would report it. Ramona would report it.
Yep.
And you're right. It would be debated, discussed, opined. And we'd be calling. Like, let's say Jordan did that yesterday.
Okay.
Punch Steve Kerr in the eye. Yep.
You know, how long should Jordan be suspended for?
Yeah, you know Skip Bayless would be on TV either saying, everybody's a big crybaby, leave Jordan alone, or Michael Jordan should be kicked out of the NBA forever. You know, it'd be some extreme, ridiculous take.
Yep.
When truth be told, Steve Kerr's coming. Lindsay, when's Steve Kerr coming on the show?
He'll be on, I believe, Monday or Tuesday of next week.
Okay, so when he comes on, you'll see that he'll say this, Mace, that fights in practice in the NBA in the 80s and 90s happened, if not every day, almost every day.
Yes.
Guys had to be separated.
Yep. All right, coming up next for you, a guy who was actually Michael Jordan's teammate, played for Jordan during two championship runs in 91 and in 92. Craig Hodges will join us next. Mason and Ireland, 710 ESPN.